Sylvia Seltoun ate her breakfast in the morning room at Yessney with a pleasant sense of ultimate victory. She was scarcely pugnacious by temperament, but belonged to that class of fighters who are pugnacious by circumstance. Fate had willed that her life should be occupied with a series of small struggles, usually with the odds slightly against her, and usually she had just managed to come through winning. And now she felt that she'd brought her hardest, and certainly her most important struggle, to a successful issue. She had married Mortimer Seltoun. Dead Mortimer, as his more intimate enemies called him, in the teeth of the hostility of his family and in spite of his indifference to women. This was an achievement that had needed some determination to carry through. Yesterday she brought her victory to its concluding stage by wrenching her husband away from London and settling him down in this remote wood-girt manor farm, which was his country house. "You'll never get Mortimer to go," his mother had said. "But if he goes, he'll stay. Yessney throws almost as much a spell over him as town does. One can understand what holds him in town, but Yessney..." The Dowager had shrugged her shoulders. There was a somber, almost savage wildness about Yessney that was certainly not likely to appeal to town-bred tastes, and Sylvia was accustomed to nothing much more sylvan than leafy Kensington. She looked on the country as something excellent and wholesome in its way, which was apt to become troublesome if you encouraged it. Distrust of town life had been a new thing with her, born of her marriage with Mortimer, and she'd watched with satisfaction the gradual fading of what she called the Jermyn Street look in his eyes, as the woods and heather had closed in on them last night. Her willpower and strategy had prevailed. Mortimer would stay. Outside the morning-room windows was a slope of turf, which the indulgent might call a lawn, and beyond its low hedge, a slope of heather and bracken dropped down into cavernous coombs, overgrown with oak and yew. In its wild, open savagery, there seemed a stealthy linking of the joy of life with the terror of unseen things. Sylvia smiled complacently as she gazed at the landscape, and then of a sudden she almost shuddered. "It's very wild," she said to Mortimer, who'd just joined her. "One could almost think that in a place like this, the worship of Pan had never quite died out."
"The worship of Pan has never died out," said Mortimer. "He's the nature god to whom all must come back at last. He has been called the father of all the gods."
Sylvia was religious in an honest, vaguely devotional way, and didn't like to hear her beliefs spoken of like this, but it was at least something new to hear dead Mortimer speak with such conviction. "You don't really believe in Pan?" she asked.
"I've been a fool in most things," said Mortimer quietly. "But I'm not such a fool as not to believe in Pan when I'm down here. And if you're wise, you won't disbelieve in him too boastfully while you're in his country."
It was not until a week later, when Sylvia had exhausted the attractions of the woodland walks round Yessney, that she made a tour of inspection of the farm buildings. A farmyard suggested in her mind a scene of cheerful bustle, with churns and flails and smiling dairymaids, and teams of horses drinking knee-deep in duck-crowded ponds. But as she wandered among the grey buildings of the manor farm, her first impression was one of crushing stillness and desolation. Then came a sense of furtive, watchful hostility, the same shadow of unseen things that seemed to lurk in the coombs and copses. From behind heavy doors and shuttered windows came the restless stamp of hoof or rasp of chain halter, and at times a muffled bellow of some stalled beast. From a distant corner, a shaggy dog watched her with intent, unfriendly eyes. As she drew near, it slipped quietly into its kennel and slipped out again as noiselessly when she'd passed by. A few hens, questing for food under a rick, stole away under a gate at her approach. Sylvia felt that if she'd come across any human beings in this wilderness of barn and byre, they too would have fled wraith-like from her gaze. At last, turning a corner, she came upon a living thing that did not fly from her. Astretch in a pool of mud was an enormous sow, ready to resent and, if necessary, repel the unwonted intrusion. It was Sylvia's turn to make an unobtrusive retreat. As she threaded her way past rickyards and cowsheds and long blank walls, she started suddenly at a strange sound. The echo of a boy's laughter, golden and equivocal. Jan, the only boy employed on the farm, a tow-headed, wizen-faced yokel, was visibly at work on a potato clearing halfway up the nearest hillside. And Mortimer, when questioned, knew of no other possible begetter of the mockery that had ambushed Sylvia's retreat. The memory of that untraceable echo was added to her other impressions of a sinister something that hung around Yessney. Of Mortimer she saw very little. Farm and woods and trout stream seemed to swallow him up from dawn to dusk. Once, following the direction she'd seen him take in the morning, she came to an open space in a copse, shut in by yew-trees, in the centre of which stood a stone pedestal, surmounted by a small bronze figure of a youthful Pan. It was a beautiful piece of workmanship, but her attention was chiefly held by the fact that a newly cut bunch of grapes had been placed as an offering at its feet. Grapes were none too plentiful at the manor house, and Sylvia snatched the bunch angrily from the pedestal. Contemptuous annoyance dominated her thoughts as she strolled slowly homeward, and then gave way to a sharp feeling of something that was very near fright. Across a thick tangle of undergrowth, a boy's face was scowling at her, brown and beautiful, with unutterably evil eyes. It was a lonely pathway. All pathways round Yessney were lonely. And she sped forward without waiting to give a closer scrutiny to this sudden apparition. It was not till she reached the house that she discovered that she'd dropped the bunch of grapes in her flight. "I saw a boy in the wood today," she told Mortimer that evening. "Brown-faced and rather handsome, but a scoundrel to look at. A gypsy, I suppose."
"A reasonable theory," said Mortimer. "Only there aren't any gypsies in these parts at present."
"Then who was he?" asked Sylvia. And as Mortimer appeared to have no theory of his own, she passed on to recount her finding of the pedestal and grapes. "I suppose it was your doing," she observed. "It's a harmless piece of lunacy. But people would think you dreadfully silly if they knew it all."
"Did you meddle with it in any way?" asked Mortimer.
"I threw the grapes away. It seems so silly," said Sylvia, watching Mortimer's impassive face for a sign of annoyance.
"I don't think you were wise to do that. I've heard it said that the wood gods are rather horrible to those who molest them."
"Horrible, perhaps, to those that believe in them. But you see, I don't," retorted Sylvia.
"All the same," said Mortimer, "I should avoid the woods and orchards if I were you, and give a wide berth to the horned beasts on the farm." It was all nonsense, of course. But in that lonely spot, nonsense seemed able to rear a brood of uneasiness.
"Mortimer," said Sylvia suddenly, "I think we'll go back to town sometime soon." Her victory had not been so complete as she'd supposed. It had carried her onto ground that she was already anxious to quit.
"I don't think you will ever go back to town," said Mortimer.
He seemed to be paraphrasing his mother's prediction as to himself. Sylvia noted with dissatisfaction and some self-contempt that the course of her next afternoon's ramble took her clear of the woods. As to the horned cattle, Mortimer's warning was scarcely needed, for she'd always regarded them doubtfully at the best. Her imagination always unsexed the most matronly dairy cows and turned them into bulls liable to see red at any moment. The ram, who fed in the narrow paddock below the orchards, she had adjudged to be of docile temper. Today, however, this usually tranquil beast was roaming with every sign of restlessness from corner to corner of his meadow. A low, fitful piping, as of some reedy flute, was coming from the depth of a neighbouring copse, and there seemed to be some subtle connection between the animal's restless pacing and the wild music. Sylvia turned her steps in an upward direction and climbed the heather-clad slopes that stretched in rolling shoulders high above Yessney. She had left the piping notes behind her, but across the wooded coombs at her feet, the wind brought her another kind of music, the straining bay of hounds in full chase. Yessney was just on the outskirts of the Devon and Somerset country, and the hunted deer sometimes came that way. Sylvia could presently see a dark body, breasting hill after hill, and sinking again and again out of sight as he crossed the coombs, while behind him steadily swelled that relentless chorus. And she grew tense with the excited sympathy that one feels for any hunted thing in whose capture one is not directly interested. At last, it broke through the outermost line of oak scrub and fern and stood panting in the open, a fat September stag carrying a well-furnished head. His obvious course was to drop down the coombe and thence make his way towards the red deer's favoured sanctuary, the sea. To Sylvia's surprise, however, he turned his head to the upland slope and came lumbering resolutely onward over the heather. "It will be dreadful," she thought. "The hounds will pull him down under my very eyes." But the music of the pack seemed to have died away again for a moment, and in its place she heard again that wild piping which rose now on this side, now on that, as though urging the failing stag to a final effort. Sylvia stood well aside from his path, half hidden in a growth of bushes, and watched him swing stiffly upward, his flanks dark with sweat, the coarse hair of his neck showing light by contrast. The pipe music suddenly shrilled around her, seeming to come from the bushes at her very feet, and at the same moment the great beast slewed round and bore directly down upon her. In an instant, her pity for the hunted animal was changed to wild terror at her own danger. The thick heather roots mocked her scrambling efforts at flight, and she looked frantically downward for a glimpse of oncoming hounds. The huge antler spikes were within a few yards of her, and in a flash of numbing fear, she remembered Mortimer's warning, "Beware of horned beasts on the farm." And then, with a quick throb of joy, she saw that she was not alone. A human figure stood a few paces aside, knee-deep in the bushes. "Drive it off!" she shrieked. But the figure made no answering movement. The antlers drove straight at her. The acrid smell of the hunted animal was in her nostrils. But her eyes were filled with the horror of something she saw other than her oncoming death. And in her ears rang the echo of a boy's laughter, golden and equivocal.